Does everyone have copies of the handouts? Everyone has copies of the handouts? Huh? Yeah? Here, take this one. I have one from my other side. Okay. How long do we have, Rabbi? 2:30? I was stuck with. Okay. So I was told that the topic that I was supposed to speak about today was the issues of building a synagogue and building a community. Obviously, to do that in an hour and leave some time for questions is like almost impossible. And I'm reminded of a very fast story, which is actually a nice story that you're welcome to use, please God, in your future pulpits. It's a story of a rabbi who is on a plane, he's on a plane and he's sitting next to a guy. And you know, rabbis like to get to know everybody around them. So he starts speaking to this person, and the guy says to him, "Listen, you know, I really don't know much about what it is to be a rabbi, but I understand that everything that you studied in all your years of rabbinical school can be summed up into one phrase: love thy neighbor as you love yourself." The rabbi, after 4 years of smicha, 5 years of smicha, 3 years of smicha, 2.5 years of smicha, depending on your way you've manipulated the system here, the rabbi realizes that, you know, it's really unfair that everything that he's learned is summarized just into this one statement: love thy neighbor as you love thyself. The rabbi says, "Well, tell me, what do you do?" And he says, "Rabbi, you would never understand what I do. I have 2 different PhDs and I'm an astrophysicist." The rabbi takes a break for a second and he says, "I understand that all that you studied in your 2 PhDs can be summarized into one statement, and that is twinkle, twinkle, little star." That's exactly the way I feel right now. That in the next hour, I'm supposed to explain how to deal with all the halakhic issues of building a shul, building a community, building a mikvah, bada kashrus. It's impossible to do in an hour. It's impossible to do in a whole series, but we'll try to give some of the basic issues and also leave some time for questions. Okay? So what I have in front of you are a few different issues here. First 2 pages are the synagogue's relationship to a Beit HaMikdash, which I think is a good forum. It's more, that part is more machshava. Pages 3 to 11 are the halachic challenges of kiruv programs, which is an important halachic issue that you need to be accustomed to. And pages 12 to 48 are the issues of mechitza, where obviously we won't be able to go through all the makorot there, but hopefully you'll get an overview of the makorot. And I look forward to Rabbi Schwartz giving you several questions on your bechina from the makorot, even the ones we don't do. So let's just go through what we need to do together here. So let's open up to the first page. Rabbi Schwartz asked me to speak about what it is to build a shul and build a community, and obviously realizing that this is a contemporary halacha class, the focus has to be halacha, but I thought it should start off with machshava, because we have to know what our mission statement is to begin with. What is the mission statement of building a shul? What is the mission statement of building a community? And I think it begins, as Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to teach, that when you discuss philosophy, philosophy has to be predicated on halacha. You cannot create a Jewish understanding of a philosophical issue if it's not really linked, if it's not connected to halacha. And I think that the halachas of a Beit Knesset all emanate from the Kedusha of a Beit Knesset, all emanate from the Kedusha of the Beit HaMikdash. We're told clearly that a Beit Knesset is a Mikdash Ma'at. We're told in the halachas, like for example, of Kampandria, it's predicated on, you can't use the shul as a Kampandria, predicated on the notion of Mikdash Ma'at. The issues of eating in a shul are predicated on Mikdash Ma'at. The issues of if a synagogue gets destroyed, God forbid, or is no longer functional, that it still has Kedusha, is focused on the notion of the Beit HaMikdash. The bottom line issue is that Beit Knesset is a Mikdash Ma'at. With that in mind, what can we learn from the structure of the Beit HaMikdash in crafting the portals of entry for our synagogues? What can we learn? And I think we should look at some of the structures that were in the Beit HaMikdash. We should look at some of the structures in the Beit HaMikdash and we can then learn how to craft our own institutions. So let's open up to the first page of the handout. Those of you who don't have handouts, maybe you can share with somebody and then you'll get handouts later. It's really important that you guys have these handouts. What? Okay. You know what? Why don't you share with somebody first? Okay. So the first mission, one of the in the first paragraph of Midos speaks about Hamisha Sha'arim Hayu L'Harabayis. There were five gates into Harabayis. Shnei Shari Chulda Min Hadaron. You had the southern entrance, which was the major entrance, was the Chulda Gate. What's interesting to note was, if you ever seen the Chulda Gates in the southern wall, that the steps to the Chulda Gates are not steps that are symmetrical. In other words, they're steps, unlike our steps, which actually by law have to be measured exactly the same, the steps to the Chulda Gates are, some are large steps, long steps, some are small steps, the width is different, the height is different. It was made that way by Chazal in order to make sure that you couldn't run into the Beit HaMikdash, but you had to walk into the Beit HaMikdash, so that you couldn't walk into the Beit HaMikdash without a sense of kavana. That was a major reason how the Chulda Gate was set up. That's a very important message for us. And that is, the first lesson that we need to learn regarding a shul is, it has to be a place of kavana. It has to be a place of tefillah where there's kavana. The joke is sometimes that there are more business deals that happen during Kriyas HaTorah than can happen during the rest of the week, simply because of the dialogues that happen within a shul. And it's a tragedy. I have always felt that more important than having one large minyan with 900 people, 1,000 people, is to make sure that you have minyanim that have a certain quality to tefillah. And different people, quality of tefillah resonates differently. You have people that like the Hashkamamim style, more in and out type of style. It doesn't mean that Shemoneh Esrei is 6 minutes, but it means that there's a particular structure. There are people who like a more of a main service. There are people like Halabach. There are people who come from the Sephardic background, Eidos HaMizrach. The idea is a shul has to be a place in which there's kavana. If you don't work with that mindset, then everything else is lost. And I think that is an important message that we find within the establishment of the Chulda Gates. And by the way, the Chulda Gates worked in the following way. There were three gates to enter and two gates to leave, because everybody came to shul on time, so you needed more gates to enter than you did to leave. If we had to craft the Chulda Gates in our shuls, it was probably would be three gates to leave and two gates to enter, because everybody leaves at the same time, but they don't all come at the same time. But there's a message there. We made a rule in the Hashkama minyan that if you came after a certain amount of time, you could not get an aliyah in that minyan. In other words, all the aliyot were given out within 15 minutes of the Hashkama minyan starting. That was a message about regarding the idea of coming on time to things. Shouldn't be that Shomi starts at 7:30 and ends at 9:15 or 9:30, that you walk in there a quarter to 9 or 8:30 or something like that, so you get half a davening. So my point is, and again, the challenge of giving these contemporary halacha classes, my goal was to do halacha, and now I'm doing machshava, so I want to spend a little bit more time on the machshava and then move to halachic issues, but I wanted you to mention that. The other thing is that you have two other gates here. One gate is called Kipunas min Hamarav, Mishamish Kenisa Liyitzia, and Tadi min Hatzafon Lahay Mishamish Kul. He had other gates that had limited use. Now, one of these gates was called the gate known as the gate Shar Tadi. Now, according to, if you look at the Rishonim and others, on this Mishnah, Tadi was a lay person that was involved in building the Beis HaMikdash, and the gate was named after him. And Kipunas was a person who gave finances in order to rebuild the second Beis HaMikdash. My point here is that a shul, in building a community, you need to have partners. There's no such thing as a rabbi who builds a community alone. You know, I was privileged to be involved in building a shul from 60 families to close to 600. And it did not happen just by Rabbi Brander waving some magic dust. It was partners. It was people who really built it. I happened to be the rabbi at the time, but there were a lot of people involved with building those institutions. It's not one person. I think there's an unbelievable message here, really, and that is, the message is that even the Beit HaMikdash, the people who gave the money and the people who gave the time are also mentioned as part of the gate. And sometimes it's harder to find people to give up their time than to give up their wealth. When you create a community, or when you're involved in building your synagogues, please God, in the future, you need to recognize that you need to have strategic partners. And I think that that message is even articulated in the building of the Beit HaMikdash. We're going to skip some of these sources because, again, I do not have enough time to do them properly. But if you look at source number 5, what's interesting is it speaks about the different gates within the inner Beit HaMikdash. The gates we talked about before were the outer, were the temple plaza gates. So one of the gates is Shar HaBachoros, and one of the gates was Shar HaMayim. Shar HaBachoros was that Shechita was permitted to be done not just by a Kohen, but also by Bechor in certain locations within the Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, Bechor, who was not the function, was not the ritual coordinator as a rabbi is or as a Kohen was in the Beit HaMikdash, but rather there were times in which you could get the Bechor involved, a Zar involved, in some of the preparatory processes of the Karbonot. My point here is that, again, I'm just amplifying the point, it's important to have partners. Not to give up the decision making on halachic issues, like Rabbi Schwartz mentioned on a Sefer Torah that's ta'ut, or issue of who can become members of the shul, who cannot become members of the shul. Let's say you have a couple that's intermarried. Do you accept that couple as members or not? That could be a great contemporary halacha topic. Let's say you have a couple that gets divorced. I'm just picking ones that have happened in the past few weeks. Let's say you have a couple that's gotten divorced, and all of a sudden, after 10 or 15 years of marriage, and the husband's gotten divorced from his wife because he just announced to the community that he's gay. Do you allow him to become a member of the shul or not? He has children in the shul. He's been married for 10 or 15 years. There's no shul in the country that doesn't struggle, no big shul in the country that doesn't struggle with any of these issues. So, obviously, the rabbi has to make the halakhic decisions and turn to poskim and other rabbanim who have a little bit more experience to give them direction. But there are things in which it's important to have partners with. The Shar HaMayim is the gate in which they brought the Mayim for the Simchas Beit HaShoeva. I've always wondered why it's called the Simchas Beit HaShoeva. After all, the whole real pomp and circumstance, the whole real experience was the water libations that happened in the Beit HaMikdash. But it's called Simchas Beit HaShoeva, which means the Simcha of drawing the water from the Shiloach. And I once discussed this with the Boston Rebbe, and he said a beautiful idea, which I think is so important. He says the reason why it's called Simchas Beit HaShoeva is because it is to remind us that it is the preparation in the act itself that defines the holiness. Even though the act happens, the theater of experience of the Simchas Beit HaShoeva is in the Beit HaMikdash. It's named after the first step, the drawing of the water, and the Shiloach, Simchat Beit HaShoeva, when you shoave the water, because the only way it's possible to have that experience in the Beit HaMikdash is if you draw the water. As Rabbi Soloveitchik would say, Ein Kedusha B'li Hakana. You can't have holiness without preparation. This is a major thing. When you create a community, when you are involved in a shul, the most important thing you need to realize is that you need to prepare. There's no such thing as doing things on the fly. It does not exist. It's not a functional way of doing things. Thank you. Drushes should not be prepared on the fly. Drushes should never be from the New York Times. Everybody has the opportunity to read the New York Times without the rav. And you have the wherewithal in a drusha to communicate to maybe tens, hundreds, thousands, depending on your kehilah. To me, having this discussion with you is so important because each of you, please God, will play roles within the Jewish community in the future. And it's important for you to realize that whatever programs that you want to do, whether it's adult education, whether it's youth, whatever you do, you need to make sure that you put in the time to prepare the programs properly. Ein kedusha b'li hachana. It's better to do less well than to do more in a disorganized, chaotic way. It's better that your brochures look good. It's better that you make sure that when you prepare and give shiurim, they're good. And if you do a few less shiurim, but they're good, it's better than doing more and they're being disorganized and just simply, you know, what you read on the Gush website or the YU website without really taking ownership of the material and being able to translate it in a way that you can effectively communicate it. That is an important klal in everything that you do. You have to budget your time in a way, and again, this is a contemporary halacha share, and I'm doing too much machshava here, but you need to do that. The idea on source number 6 is an issue of the idea of the role of music. A shul should not just be a place of prayer. That's a shtivel. A shul should be an epicenter of various Jewish experiences similar to the paradigm of the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash had a Beit Knesset. The Beit HaMikdash had a Sanhedrin that dealt with social issues. The Beit HaMikdash had a lost and found. The Beit HaMikdash had a place in which the Chasan and Kala would sit and be extended mazel tov to, and the Avel would be comforted. In fact, the verbiage of Hamakom Yenachem Etchem is really just simply verbiage that was really found in the Beit HaMikdash, because the people who were Avelim walked differently in the Beit HaMikdash, and therefore you knew if they were Avelim or not. And it said that the person who resides in this area should extend words of comfort to you. That's how you got the Hamakom instead of Hashem Yenachem Etchem. The Beit HaMikdash was a place of a plethora of spiritual opportunities. A shul, not everybody connects to God in the same way. And then I think I mentioned last night at Sichas Mussar, I'm not sure, that Yom HaKippurim is called Yom HaKippurim. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say, not Yom Kippur, because my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu might be different than the person sitting next to me. It's Yom HaKippurim. It's the day of many Yom Kippurs. My tshuva process and my friend's tshuva process may be different. My rendezvous with HaKadosh Baruch Hu might be different. Just like the Beit HaMikdash had a plethora of spiritual opportunities, and not every portal of entry was connected with every person, the same thing is true with a shul. A shul has to have several different portals of entry. There should be social action. There should be adult education, youth work. There should be, obviously, serious minyanim, and all of those different things. And that idea is also highlighted in the Mishnah on page 2. And that is that the Mishnah on page 2 tells us how they took the blood and the fats from the Mizbeach, and those bloods and fats were used to fertilize the Kidron Valley. Again, showing that the Beit HaMikdash even had an ecological component to it. It was concerned about the world around them. Your shul needs to be concerned when there's a disaster in New Orleans. For a shul not to be involved in helping with that disaster is wrong. A shul has to be connected to those issues. Let me just finish these points, and then before we go to the halachic issues, I'll take questions. Source number 8 speaks about that lost and found that was on the Beit HaMikdash. Again, I think a social component. Source number 9 speaks about the building in the eastern gate, Shar Mizrach, of two offices, one for Chassanin to extend Mazel Tov, and one to Avelim. Source number 10 speaks about the ultimate way to give tzedakah, and this is an important thing, because every one of you, hopefully, who have pulpits will have a rabbinical discretionary fund. First of all, it's important that you understand the laws of a rabbinical discretionary fund. And if, please God, when you get to the point you have pulpits and you want to ask that question, come to me. There's certain rules and regulations, or else you could be held liable for your discretionary fund, and the government can say all that money collected, you have to pay personal tax on. So there's certain rules and regulations. And if, please God, you collect a lot of money, it could be a challenge. But how you give tzedakah, that is to be done b'tzniut, doesn't need to be announced, it doesn't need to be, you know, done in that way. The Beit HaMikdash had a room in which you went in there. If you needed money, you took money out. If you had the wherewithal to give, you gave. No one knew whether you emptied your pockets or filled your pockets, so to say, from that room. That's the way a Rav should act with issues of tzedakah. That's the way a Rav should act when somebody needs to go to a day school and needs extra help. It's not something that the Rav needs to put on his resume. It's not something he has to share with the whole world. He does it with tzniut. And don't worry, your matzen tovim will follow you. It doesn't need to be announced to the whole world. And the final statement there is perhaps the most important, and that is the institution of the way the windows were created in the Beis HaMikdash. And that is, the windows were set up in a way in which it didn't receive light from the outside world as much as it shed light into the outside world. A shul has to be a place that obviously norms, the cultural norms and mores of society, this postmodernist society that we live in, with all of its challenges, and to borrow from the philosophers of our time, Derrida and others, in which there is the deconstruction of the meta-narrative of community that will enter into the portals of Yeshua simply because people are influenced by it. It's a me generation. It's a hedonistic society. But our agenda and our goal as Rabbanim is to recognize that our shuls are places that send out light. Our goal is that our windows are shaped in a way in which we don't receive the impurities as much as we're able to displace the impurities by shedding light. It's a very important message in the way the windows were crafted. A shul can be the epicenter of the community. There's a reason why Chazal said that the shul should be the tallest building within the community. In Boca, it's actually, please God, we'll arrange sometime a little trip. We'll do it in January, not in June or August or September. It's the tallest building in the whole area. It's in the center of the whole area. There's a certain message that's being communicated by that architecture. It's halachic architecture. The halacha says someone builds a floor higher than the Beis Knesset, you can actually ask them to take down that floor or donate that the shul should get a little taller. But the bottom line is that there is an issue there. But more important, I think, than the physical structure is the spiritual message that I'm trying to communicate. That is, a shul can really be the arsenal which shares a certain message around. Now, I have spent the past 29 minutes or so dealing with machshava, and this is a contemporary halacha class, so we got to get into some serious halachic issues. I'll take one or two questions, and then we're going to get into serious halachic issues. Yes.
The shul is a mikdash mat becoming a community center. Certainly, is a very compelling concept. However, as far as I know, it's not a historical concept. It's a relatively modern invention. It sounds like a post facto justification.
That's not true. If you look, well, first of all, I've never used it as a post facto justification. I just felt that's what I should do. But if you look in Europe or others, they all had, and you look in Eretz Israel, look in the old shuls of the old city, you look, they all had attached to them houses. The whole idea of making kiddush on Friday night in the shul was why? Because people used to have their meals. It was a place, it was a place of social, it was a place in which the poor would come to. If you look at the shul that's known as the Chorva shul, you'll see right next to the Chorva shul, the Ramban shul, you'll see there was mamish, a base tamkui that was set up by the shul there. If you look throughout Europe, that was a consistent message. There was actually a kehila tax that went to support those things. Just the opposite. I would say that if you look historically, shuls always had that component, and then they were dwarfed into just being places of davening, and now as communities need the anchor more, hopefully they're expanding. And I would suggest that if you trace the historical development of the halacha of kiddush in a shul, you'll see it's predicated on that. And the whole idea that when you establish a new shul, whether you should say kiddush or not, is simply based on the idea, because whoever uses the shul anymore to gather the poor to eat on Friday night, so therefore the whole idea saying kiddush there became a non-issue. But clearly the shul was a place in which these things happened on a regular basis. Okay, so I don't think that, well, yes.
I also think that you need a post-factual justification for it, but they didn't have women's sections. What happened to the same community?
Who said they didn't have women's sections?
These old shuls, you see them in Europe, you see them in Jerusalem.
They actually all had women's sections. Most of them actually followed to the T the structures that are set up in the Beis HaMikdash, and that is their women's sections were balconies. That's totally predicated on the institution that was mentioned in the Gemara. suspect there is a one of the poskim, one of the rishonim, I think I put it in my handouts, asked, why is there no Hilchas Mechitza in Shulchan Aruch? And the answer that they give is, since it was so obvious that every shul needed it and had it, there was no need to actually discuss it in greater detail as opposed to other halachas of Beit Knesset. It's clear if you look at all the shuls in the Golan Galil area now that are being uncovered, it's clear that they had a second floor. Their structures were such, they had support systems and such. And actually, many of the shuls in Golan Galil actually had that back room, that supper room I just articulated. It was behind the Arna Kodesh. And throughout Europe, at least the places in Europe that I've traveled, and I'm talking about the former Soviet Union and other places of that nature, there are always shuls with, whether it's the Ramah shul or other shuls, they always had, most of them had balconies, but they always had something. Even the shul that was called the conservative shul in Krakow had a mechitza, and that was a conservative shul because I think they had a choir or something like that. But you know, the bottom line is that there always was mechitza. I don't think that that's an accurate statement. I think that unfortunately, what's happened is that we've relegated shuls to a very limited experience, and because of that, we've paid the price. And the price is that sometimes you have a lot of Jews living in an area, but they still have no community. Just because you have a lot of Jews living in an area doesn't mean you have a Jewish community. And the struggle that a shul, I think, can achieve is to create a Jewish community, even if there are, whether there are a lot or a little Jews living in an area. Anyone else? Okay. One of the questions that needs to be dealt with in any community, especially those out of town, is what do you do when you do outreach? How do you effectively do outreach in a way that's consistent with halacha? Perhaps when you invite somebody to your house, or perhaps when you invite somebody to a Shabbos experience, whether they turn Friday into Shabbos, or whether they come to your shul on a regular basis, stuff like that, perhaps you violated the iser of l'fnei iver lo titein mechshol, simply because they're now going to drive. Are you allowed to engage the extended Jewish community, even though you know in the process, at least initially, they may drive? This is a very important halachic cornerstone in community building, especially when you're doing outreach. Can these people be part of the minyan? Can they get an aliyah? Can they lead the davening? What are the parameters? What are the protocols of that stuff? Does everyone understand the question? Okay. So again, we don't have that much time to deal with the issue, but I'm going to run through the issue with you hopefully with some clarity. And I want to just let you know that on the 10th page of the handout is an article. It's not in the form that it appeared, because I couldn't find the form that it appeared, so I found the, it's an article that I wrote that the Young Israel rabbinate asked me to write on this halakhic issue, so it summarizes the pieces, so in case I don't get to everything, there's some summaries there, but let's hold off the summary. I'd like to share with you the whole development. Let's turn to page 3. The first, the purpose of page 3, and again, I take Rabbi Schwartz to his word that my expectation in preparing this large packet was that you guys would really read the sources, and this was not going to be a babysitting hour and a half where I would read every source with you. So I'm just going to tell you basically what I wanted you to accomplish on page 3. Page 3 is several different sources that accentuate the responsibility of doing kirov work, the halachic responsibility. According to the Rambam, it's probably mitzvah ase gimel, that the way you get to know HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the way Avram got to know HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that is to share the love of God with others. That idea is highlighted in the Sifri. That idea is slightly highlighted in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Shekol Yisrael Reivim Zevazeh. That idea is highlighted in the Gemara in Shabbos. That idea is highlighted in the Gemara in Brachas, the famous Gemara of Rabbi Meir. But Rabbi Meir did not pray for the death of the sinners, but rather the death of their sins. That idea is highlighted by the Chafetz Chaim, which I did not put in there, which says that the mitzvah of kirov is a din in hashalat haveda, or as the Minchas Chinuch says, it's a din in lo tamod adam reyacha. Here we're talking about spiritual blood, spiritual returns, but they expand the bandwidth of the mitzvah itself. So clearly, it's a halachic responsibility. But even our most, and this is a very important idea, and that is, no matter what we want to do, we need to make sure that it's consistent with halacha. that especially goes for women's issues. It's very important that we make sure that women play a role within the structures of our shuls and our communities. But we need to make sure that it's consistent with halacha. You know, the Benot Halacha wanted nafla in Eretz Yisrael, but they asked a shayla when they wanted nafla. In my community, we have tried to make sure that women play a very important role. The president of the Kollel is a woman. The president of the elementary school is a woman. The president of the high school used to be a woman. But there are certain things that I have not been in favor of. I have not been in favor of women's prayer groups. I did not feel that those were, I'm not suggesting that those who do it are wrong, I just personally did not feel that it was consistent with a halachic norm in which women grew from the experience, not to say that the women involved in it aren't spiritually focused, because they are, but I felt personally that a women's prayer service is really smoke and mirrors, because it's not an authentic, I didn't feel that it is the best experience to give women. My focus was, and still is, that to make sure that there are other experiences. For example, the Kollel of Boca now has a woman that's a member of the Kollel. She teaches within the Jewish community. She teaches within the extended community. Talmud Torah is a very important thing. We have Hakafot on Simchas Torah for women when the men get aliyot, because it's just absurd. You have all these men get aliyot and a whole bunch of women just sitting around doing nothing. And what happened was, I didn't want to have women's Hakafot with the regular Hakafot, simply because I thought that there's too much divisiveness within the community whether a woman should hold a Torah or not, even though halakhically it's not a problem. But I thought that it would create too much division. So instead of creating that division, when the men get aliyot, there's a second set of hakafot in a separate room where no one else goes into that room other than women. And the women, if they want, to have women's hakafot. But I thought that when it came to women's prayer groups, although if somebody started a women's prayer group in the community, it would not be my place to speak out against it, but I was never comfortable having it in the shul. And simply, I did not think that that's where I wanted to focus. I'm totally into making sure that women play significant roles in lay. I'm totally into making sure that they have spiritual roles and making sure when we started our high school, it's a prerequisite that all women study Torah Shabbat Pel also. But I wanted to make sure that I create portals of entry that I felt were totally consistent and within the purview of all halacha. Therefore, my focus was on Limud HaTorah. My focus was on experiences that just articulated, making sure that the shul had a user-friendly machitza, which we'll get to in a second. Not that the women were somewhere behind some type of thick curtain and they couldn't feel that they were participating in the davening. It was to make sure that they could, feel that it was a friendly environment in which they could be involved. What about doing kiruv work? Page 4. Well, let me just. Yes.
Why do you think there's a problem with the word
Moses? I don't know.
The Zohar says
you can't do it.
What?
No. Yeah, but the Zohar. Sorry. The Zohar might say the Shulchan Aruch says you can. The Aruch Hashulchan says you can. Rav Moshe Feinstein says you can. The Rav Avadia Yosef says you can.
But you want to know the reason. That's the reason.
Okay, stop.
I think there's salvation centers in the Torah that they women didn't hold the Torah. It wasn't an issue of me, but Shiran is an issue of the Torah.
That what?
They never held the Torah in the past, so we should have.
It's Torah too.
What? First of all, I can't believe Rabbi Soloveitchik said such a thing. And I want you to know that before, that it's very important to recognize something. First of all, I think that Reb Shechter's work in Nefesh HaRav is an unbelievably, unbelievably great work, and it doesn't need my hafsama. I enjoy the fact that I've quoted many times in that book, in that sefer, from him. But it's important to realize that Rabbi Soloveitchik never told Rabbanim exactly what to do. When he gave smicha, he didn't put his phone number in the back. In other words, the point was that he gave people guidance and direction. And I can't believe that I haven't seen that part of Nefesh HaRav, so, and I can't argue with Rabbi Shechter, you know, what he forgot, I'll never know. So the bottom line is that the bottom line is, if you ever forgotten anything, the bottom line is that the halacha is pretty clear that a woman's allowed to hold the Sefer Torah. I just thought the women's prayer groups are not consistent with an authentic prayer experience because it's missing Darush and Kedush and stuff like that. I know the Rav was not happy with women's prayer groups in synagogues themselves. I was his shamish at the time that those things were going on. I thought, again, my feeling was that although there was pressure to create a women's prayer group, it was not something that I was comfortable with because of the fact that, not because, God forbid, I don't believe that women have to play proactive roles, because I think I just articulated several that they do play. I have to tell you, I remember one of the times that Rabbi Schechter came to the community, I called him before and I said, there's a girl that's having a bat mitzvah, and what we do is after davening is over, we allow her to get up if she wants and to give and to share words of Torah after davening is over. And we have all the men take off their talisim, so davening is officially over. I said, I don't know if Rabbi Schechter wants to come that Shabbos. Maybe we'll work out a different Shabbos. And Rabbi Schechter told me he wanted to come. And he, after he heard this girl make this presentation, again, it was after all davening was over, no one was wearing a talis. I officially announced, even the president had made his announcements, so davening was really over. And everyone took off their talis, and I announced that davening is officially over. Then she came from the women's section. And Rabbi Schechter said to me, why don't more communities do this? In other words, if you do it in a way that's halachically sensitive, and you have discussions with Mora Hara in advance, you'll find they're a lot more open than you will in any of their publications. Okay? Yes?
So when the Rav speaks about women's role in the synagogue, so let's say the way it's generally done, the hakafos and stuff, so is that more just the thing for this generation, or would Rav say that, so how do you feel about it?
I don't pretend to, there's enough people who speak in the name of the Rav who didn't hear him say what they say. They heard him. So I'm not going to speak in the name of
you.
I'm not, all right. Well, I'll be answering both accounts then. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, I don't believe that, you know, I don't know exactly what Rabbi Soloveitchik would hold on any of these issues, but for me personally, I think that a shul has to be a place consistent with what we've just said, and that is consistent with the fact that you have to make sure it follows the notion of a mikdash ma'at. It has to be halachic 100%, but it also has to be open to the culture of the time and make sure that people feel that they can grow spiritually in there. Would I have started women's hakafot if I didn't feel that there was a group that needed it? Most probably not. Would I have been supportive of mandated Torah Shabbat Peh for the high school, even though not all women are happy with that? That's probably yes. I don't think that this issue is black and white. I'm not sure it's relevant because I think we live in a culture that you have to make those accommodations. And some would maybe argue that that's why there are women's prayer groups. Me personally, and again, I don't speak out against anyone who has them, because I believe that most women are, there is a spiritual agenda there that should not be ignored or be mavatal, easy to be mavatal people. That seems to be the norm in our society. But it, for me personally, I did not feel that that was an authentic way to give women a voice. And I wanted to do it in a way that was authentic. That's for me personally. Yeah?
Is there a halakhic issue with having a woman serve as a president or a...
Well, I didn't, and then we never had a president of the synagogue, but the issue of Srara, I believe that for the most part, like the president of the Kolel or something like that, the Srara issues are really more, presidents don't make decisions on their own, especially the president of the Kolel, where all substantive hiring decisions are made by the dean of the Kolel. But I think it depends on the protocols. That, I think that should be another cheer that Tom should give about Srara issues and women. But you should just realize that presidents, you know, a treasurer signs the checks and things of that nature. It's not the same paradigm that we may be accustomed to in other structures where a president, you know, makes decisions in a unilateral way. It's not like that anymore. There are board structures. Part of the problem with language is you borrow a term president from 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and you use it now, and you think that you associate all of the psak with it. You have to look at the psak of what their concerns were and ask yourself whether a president still fulfills that concern. I'm not convinced that it does. We can discuss the issues of Sarara at a different point. I do want to get to the issues of Lifnei Iver here, and let's go through them. So what about Lifnei Iver? Inviting individuals to your house or to your services. So you have a very interesting tshuva of Rav Moshe Sternbach. Everyone's heard of Rav Moshe Sternbach here?
Yeah.
What? No? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. So Rav Sternbach has an unbelievable tshuva in which he says there's no iser of Lifnei Iver lo titein mechshol. Why? Because Lifnei Iver lo titein mechshol means that you had intention of fooling the person. I had intention of giving the person a bad stock tip. I had an intention of causing the person to stumble. Even though they've driven on Shabbos, that was never my intention. My intention was to give them a Shabbos experience. So he says a chiddush, which no one else holds up, and that is that Lifnei Iver lo titein mechshol is not an iser when your end goal was not to be machshil the person, irrelevant that in the process of your end goal, the means that person used created a mechshol of some type. That's a very hard tshuva to understand. Because what he's saying basically is the means become justified through your end goal. Not convinced that Lifnei Iver lo titein mechshol follows that protocol. But that is what Rav Sternbach does say. However, I think we can deal with the issue in a more, what I would call, normative fashion by simply looking at several other tshuvas. Some of these bios, well, most of them are not my own, they're just cut and pasted from Bar Ilan responsive literature. So, if we look at source number five, if we look at page five, the Malamed Lehoel, already in the late 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, speaks about in a minyan, in which there were a few Mechal Shabbos before Hesya. Not only did they keep their stores open after they went to davening, but they also would smoke and things of that nature. They don't make Kiddush, they don't have Dala, if they can be mitzarif to a minyan. So Malamed Lehoel has an unbelievable tshuva here that he basically says that they can be, more than basically, he says that they can, if you look at the, again, I've highlighted the pieces that are important. We don't have time to read all of them, but if we look at the page 5, the middle of page 5, let's look at what it says there. Hayotze mikol hanal, sha'af al pi din mechal ha-shabbos b'frahesya ein mitzarif l'minyan, ah, bizman hazeh, nohagim lahakel af be'eretz Hungaria, u mikol shekein be'eretz Ashkenaz. Hungary, which is a little bit more religious than Germany, we permitted it. And then he tells a story. V'zichruni sh'pam achatz ira avelos l'ish echad, shechanuto petuach b'shabbos, v'hu echad mibale batim shel kihilatenu. What was the shul's name? Kahal Adas Yisrael. V'yareid lifnei ateva v'beis kenesa shekihilatenu. This was on Shabbos. This guy went in front led the minyan. Achagava yada l'rasot oto l'fayis to shelo yirad o mibnei shakahal yiradnu al zeh. But Acharkach, in other words, the community wasn't too happy. The guy was Mechal Shabbos. He had a store open across the street or something. But Acharkach, Halach Zela Ish, the base Knesset, Shochevra Shas. But Af Shagabai, the Sham Haya Ish Chared, the Yurei Sashem, Yurei Shemayim, Hinicho, Yurei Lifnei Hateva, Beli Menia, the Kashir Shalti Tagabai, Lama Lomanu, Amar li shekein hu gam kein minag miyamin bekodmim bebet hamidrash depo de ein monim leray lifnei ateva hananashim shemischaram patuch b'shabbos the kibin shaharabanim d'sham shahayu anshei shem lo michu mistaima hayatama v'nimukam imam. And what was the reason for it? But after some cause that mashakatzu gam kein b'shut binyan tzion hakadoshot simchav gimel shemchalei shabbos b'zmanenu nechshavim kitzas. Kitinok shenishba levein hanachrim. In other words, the whole notion of tinok shenishba, that machal Shabbos. Bipnei she'av v'sinur harabim, rov Yisrael v'arsenu machalalei Shabbosim. V'ein datam bazel l'kfor v'yikare emunaseinu. It's not their interest to be kofrim. V'chein higit li harav. It goes on, etc., etc. And here's the piece I want to say. Meshulam Zalman Kohen Zal B'Shem Ha'Gaon Bal Shol Meshev Shekasav Shanashim Me'America. If we're so makil, you know, in Hungary, which is the bastion of Torah Judaism and Ashkenaz, Ein Nefsalim Aydei Chilo Shabbos Shalahem Mivnei Shehem Kitinokes or Kitinok Shenishba Levein Anachrim. Here you have the issue of the idea that we should realize, first of all, that those that drive in Shabbat, for the most part, are considered a Tinuk Shenishba. Tinuk Shenishba is not only those who were not educated properly, but also those who may have been educated properly, but simply, you know, got involved in the community, got involved in the extended Jewish community in a culture that was not consistent with Torah Judaism. And again, I hope you don't mind I use these as examples. In Boca, there are two mailmen who serve the area around the Jewish community. One of them is a Chaim Berlin graduate. And this is not a put down on Chaim Berlin, because it could be a YU graduate, a Lakewood graduate, a Torah V'Das graduate. This guy happens to be a Chaim Berlin graduate. He delivers, when my wife was sitting Shiva, we didn't get mail for 7 days because he felt it was poshnish to deliver mail to a house that was sitting Shiva, so he delivered the mail after 7 days, right? The guy knows. He drives his truck. He wishes everyone good Shabbos as he's... So there's all these issues we live in an area that no longer is serviced by him. There's all these issues about Tchum Shabbos, of mail getting delivered by this guy at Shabbos. You know, are the Tchum Shabbos issues, because he's delivering the mail from outside Tchum, or comes outside Tchum. A Jew mamash is delivering it. We can spend the rest of the time discussing the notion of Tchum Shabbos and how it affects whether these guys are allowed to take in their mail Motzei Shabbos, they have to wait for the Bechdei Sheyafsu, a whole bunch of nice sugyas there that we could discuss. But we're not going to do that. My point is that here's a guy who came from a religious institution, but did not grow up in a religious environment. And because of that, did not follow. And I'd like to just point out, this is Derech Agav, but very important, we always view the Baal Tshuva movement as a movement for those who did not grow up observant. The new frontier in the Baal Tshuva movement, which has not yet been seen in newspapers, or there isn't an article yet about it in the Jewish Observer, or Jewish Action, Jewish Press, Jewish Week, anywhere else, the new frontier for Baal Tshuva will be those who grew up in a religious environment, walked away from it, and now we need to figure out a way to bring them back. And you can't do it the same way, because you can't do an explanatory service when they can tell you there's muksa machmas mius, there's muksa machmas this, there's psik resh lo nichale, there's psik resh lo ichvasle. In other words, they know the word lingo as well as you know the lingo. It just didn't buy into it because of some type of negative experience. And it's a really interesting issue. It's an important issue that you should realize. There's a whole Baal Tshuva movement out there that has to be dealing with people who were, you know, formerly from, not those who were not from at all. One second, let me just finish these pieces, because I'm starting to get a little nervous. I'm not even getting up to Mechitza. So the piece one? Okay. I'm trying to honor what I said I was going to do. So the issue of the Gemara and Avodah Zarah, see, well, this whole packet really could be a whole semester. Really should be a whole semester. But I'm just doing, I'm just trying to be productive here. So we have to understand, what is the Isser of Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Hashom? What is the Isser? So the Gemara and Avodah Zarah is pretty clear what the Isser is. The Isser of Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Hashom is that if a person is a nazir and he does not have the wherewithal to have wine because he's on one side of the river and all the wine is on the other side of the river, and you bring it over by boat to his side, you have transgressed the Isser of Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Mechshol. And here's the operating phrase. This is the key phrase. This is the essence nekuda of all psak on this issue. Lifnei Iver has to be that without you, the person would not have been able to violate the Isser. That's the Etzem Nekuda. And I'm going to prove that Etzem Nekuda, even though it really doesn't need proof, because it's Mamash the Gemara and Avodah Zarah. How do we know that's the Etzem Nekuda? Let's look at the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch tells us that it's usher to sell things that are for Avodah Zarah. I can't sell, you know, Buddha, things of that nature in my store, because I'm over Lifnei Iver, because a guy is also not allowed to be involved in Avodah Zarah. So the question then becomes, so if that's the case, so the Shulchan Aruch says, however, if you're in a mall, I'm paraphrasing the Shulchan Aruch, if you're in a mall and there's three other people selling Buddhas, you can sell Buddha also, because Lufnei Iver is only an Isser of as I just mentioned, betray Avrei Nara, and that is if the Buddha is only on the other side of the ocean and you're bringing Buddha to the Gentiles. But if there are other people that are selling Buddhas, you can sell Buddhas also. You might not get the Jewish Citizen of the Week award, as the Ramah says, but the bottom line is that you still have not violated the Isser of Lufnei Iver, and that's what the Shulchan Aruch says. Yesh Omrim, Hada Asa Limkor Lehem Devar Mashayachim La'Avodasam, Hayu Dafkam Ein Lehem Acher V'Yotibo, O Shelo Yochlu Lifnos Mamakam Acher, Avo Em Yicholim Lifnos Mamakam Acher, Mutar Limkor Lehem Kol Davar, V'Yesh Machmirim. However, the Ramah says, V'Nagu Lahaka Kesvar Rishona. But then he says, V'Chol Baal Nafesh Yachmir La'atzmo. This idea is also found in the Tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, where Rav Moshe Feinstein equates the notion of Messiah L'Dei Aveira, Lifnei Iver, as one and the same. Rav Moshe Feinstein is asked the following issue. Rav Moshe Feinstein is asked, I have a catering hall, and the catering hall is glatt kosher, but the entertainment at the catering hall might not be such glatt kosher. There might be mixed dancing, there might be certain other things. So the question is, am I allowed to rent out my catering hall to a client who may not follow all the laws of tzniut, consistent perhaps with what should be followed? Moshe Feinstein says, you're permitted to rent out the catering hall. It's not an issur of Lifnei Iver. They can go next door and rent out a different catering hall. Lifnei Iver is only if without you they couldn't be nichshol. But since they can be nichshol without you, there's no issur whatsoever. Just I'm amplifying the Lifnei Iver point. This idea is also highlighted in the Mishnah in Shviyas, in the commentary of the Ritva on Avodah Zarah, which really paraphrases the Mishnah. And that's the middle of page 7, where the Mishnah in Shviyas says that in Shviyas you cannot sell instruments that can be used only for Isser. You cannot sell a plow. But what about a hand sickle that could be used to cut things in your in your house, but also could be used as Isser? That you're allowed to sell. Something that can be used for a davar aser and a davar mutter, that you can sell. And the Ritva explains in Masechet Avodah Zarah, why is that permitted? Because it's not considered Lifnei Iver. Because the person can use the instrument either for a davar mutter or a davar aser. And since you have not created the you're not the reason, they would have violated it without you. You've done nothing wrong by selling the instrument, even if they use it in an inappropriate way. This idea is also highlighted in the Sridei Eish. Again, I encourage you to read these tshuvas and not just, take it that this is what I'm saying the Sridei Eish says, but this is what the Sridei Eish says. Somebody selling their renting out their store because they're going to America for a year, and somebody's buying their store, and that person might want to keep the store open on Shabbos. Am I allowed to rent out my store for a year to somebody who might expand the hours to include Shabbos? And again, the Sridei Eish says, there's no Lifnei Iver there, because you're not requiring the person to open the store on Shabbos. It's not a prerequisite in the rent. There are some walls, by the way, that it's a prerequisite that the store stay open on Shabbos. Here, in this case, the paradigm was that you could keep the store open from Sunday till Erev Shabbos. The fact that he wants to keep it open on Shabbos is not your problem, because there's no issur of Lifnei Iver, because you're not asking him to do it in an inappropriate way. Towards that end, I'd like to suggest the following. We can turn to page 9 for a second. Page 9 is the most important page on this handout, because this is an unpublished letter of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. So no one here is allowed to publish it, okay? So it's an unpublished letter of Rav Shlomo Zalman, which I know for 100%, I know it to be an accurate letter. So let's discuss this for a second before we get to the letter. How can we do outreach work that does not violate Lifnei Iver? On the one hand, we can easily say, how I can do outreach work that doesn't violate Lifnei Iver? Simply because I know the person's going to drive with me or without me. So if they're driving if they're driving to the mall, instead they're driving to me, perhaps I'm not over-listening either. That in itself is probably the good enough thing. Let me just finish the point, then I'll take questions. However, I think a better way of dealing with the listening ear issue is that I offer hospitality. I go to this person, I send out a mailing to the community. I have a free explanatory service on the High Holiday, which is a mailing that just went out last week. The Kollel sends out a free explanatory service for the High Holiday. It's free. In the mailing, it says Shabbos hospitality available, or hospitality, that's not Shabbos, hospitality available for those who do not live in, or for those who wish hospitality, do not live in walking distance of the synagogue. And there are people who always take us up on that offer. But by me putting in that one line, I've obviated the whole problem of Lifnei Iver, because I've offered a mutter way for them to achieve the goal. I don't have to be someone like Rav Sternbach, who says, you can send out that mailing, Rabbi Branger, without that, because your end goal is not to be mitzvah anyone. You just want to give them a Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur experience. But I can follow all of the shitas on Lifnei Iver by simply, I can follow them all simply by saying it's not Lifnei Iver because they can make the decisions on their own, Dava Asa, Dava Mutta. But I can definitely follow all the shitas, and this is what is the standard protocol that I think that all of us in this room should follow, and that is by offering Shabbos hospitality, even if they won't say yes. You invite a family over for a meal, you offer Shabbos hospitality, please, you're welcome to stay for the whole Shabbos. Even if the person says, Rabbi, I only want to stay for Friday night. I only want to come for Friday night. You know, that's fine, that's not your problem anymore. You've obviated the Isser of Lifnei Iver for yourself. That, I think, is of critical importance. I just want to finish one more piece and then I'll take all the questions, okay, before we get to the Mechitza piece. Take all the questions. This protocol is a protocol that also Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach mentioned, and this was a protocol that was not publicly published, but a few of us who are, you know, who are dealing with these issues, we were sent this tshuva, and I actually scanned it in and, you know, wanted to give it to you guys. This was asked by the, you know, head of Or Sameach, or the Mashkiach of Or Sameach, and he asked the following thing. This is about beginner services and other things of that nature, and he quotes a Malami Laho Elir, and let's read Aleph Beis Gimel and Dalet. Number one, Mutar lahazmin gam mi shegor rachok mimakom atfila ulahatzia lo makom lo, I guess, karov lemakom ba'ofen shelo yitzarech klal l'chal Shabbos va'ach im lo yikabel at ha'tza'a ein chayav la'gid lo sheyimna mishum kach lavo v'gam ein tzrichin lahazir oto she'asa la'giv erechav. That's exactly what we just said. B, he wants to remind us, let's not make our shuls places in which parking lots are open, because then people don't realize there's a little bit of a difference. It doesn't mean that people who drive to shul can't park on the swales, can't park in a field, can't park somewhere else, but perhaps let's not keep our parking lots open. That's what this is. Ratsui lo etzarek misha adayim l'chal shakrib hesel minyan l'chol davar shevudusha nidra shasara. He suggested that you don't count them in the minyan, even though the malami l'choel would clearly be matzer to count them in the minyan. And so yesh amin litzmoch, the malami l'choel would clearly allow them, because they're definitely in the carrier of kinushin nishba. Im yesh atzarek kisherim b'lodam, efshar likro otam gam la'alot l'torah, since the aliyahs of the Torah, you know, again, as Rabbi Schwartz said, the whole thing of Hilchos Kriyas Torah, there's a minimum amount of people that actually need to get aliyahs anyways. We've expanded what that minimum is. Again, I don't have time to go through the halachic issues there, but there is not an issue of allowing them to get an aliyah, nor is there an issue for allowing them to be involved in Birkat Kohanim. So I believe the Lifnei Iver, Lo Titein Lecho issue is obviated with the understanding and with the issue of the fact that simply if you extend ways of opportunities, you can really change the world by, you know, through a piece of chicken you can change your life. Yes. Take some questions here, and then we'll go on if we can. Yes. We'll start. We'll just walk our way. Please.
I was a little confused about a person that grows up religious and then possibly turns the other way. I was wondering. I mean, mean, it seems that now we're attributing his term to environmental circumstances. What would be your question?
I give you an example of a case that happened a few weeks ago. And we had a discussion with Rabbi Schechter on this. I'm new to this piece. I don't know the political ramifications of me telling these cases, so it's a certain, you're going to benefit from my naivete. Take advantage of it, I'll be more guarded in the future of the cases I give. Here's a girl who grew up who became Shomer Shabbos. She went to a university in New York and was dating a Jewish kid. And the kid raped her. It had such a profound psychological effect on her that she walked away from being a Shomer Shabbos. She now is getting her life back together again. And the problem is that she was her parents who raised her are not her biological parents. She was adopted. And when she was adopted, she was converted by a conservative rabbi. Now she's no longer Shomer Shabbos. She knows what Shabbos is about. She went to elementary school from high school and from college. What do we do? These are when Rabbi Schechter's phone number is very helpful. Because normally I would say you can't convert her. She's not Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Torah Mitzvot 100%. She keeps a kosher home, but she drives on Shabbos and stuff like that. In discussions with Rabbi Schechter in this very particular case, he was able to figure out a way in which we can convert her. And I don't want to suggest that this is a suggestion for future cases of this nature. Every case like this has its nuances and needs to be discussed with the Gadol b'Yisrael. Not that I'm not suggesting that rabbis abdicate their halachic responsibility to a Gadol b'Yisrael. Rabbanim need to know how to paskin halacha. It's not just having on your palm a Rishachta's phone number. It's not the right way to govern your shul. You govern your shul, you govern your community by becoming mora ha-horai on your own. But when you need a little help, it's nice to know that Rabbi Schechter's there with a helping hand. But that does not mean that every single time you have a shaila, you run, you learn the sources yourself. I'm going to give another case to prove that idea also, if you don't mind. So my point is that we felt that one of the issues that we felt was, since she's still within the paradigm of Ikari Amuna, and according to many Rishonim, that's what's required for conversion, because of certain experiences that she went through, we were able to be more lenient. The reason why I'm sharing you is a case, first of all, it's the first case that jumped out of my head, because it's a very recent case. And secondly, it also highlights the idea that there are times in which there are cultural impacts that cause a person to walk away from full observance that allow you to be considered tinuch tenishba despite the background that you have. I'm not suggesting that that's a blanket for everybody. I'm just suggesting you should realize that. I want to give one more example about the role of a rav to be a mora hara, not just turn to a gadol. And it's an important example, and this happened many years ago. In North Miami Beach, there was a couple that sent all their kids to the Frumma schools. And what happened was, he started working more than one job, he wasn't home, and she became very bored with her life. And he found out, he thought that she was having an extramarital affair. So he went to his rav, and his rav said, hire private detectives, which was not the right thing to tell him, but he did. And to protect the detectives found her having these rendezvous with another member of the shul in a hotel. And there was videotapes, not of the actual mafsin that happened within the room, but of their rendezvous at this hotel. The minute that happened, they started going through divorce. But the interesting thing happened during divorce. They were forced to talk to each other. And all of a sudden, they realized they still love each other. All these months beforehand that they lived as two single people in the same house, but they didn't talk to each other. And now, all of a sudden, they started to talk to each other. So what happened was, they wanted to stay married. The Rabbanim in North Miami Beach didn't want to touch this because it was a political nightmare. They said, well, why don't we give it to the new guy on the block, the guy from Boca, and we'll let him play with it a little bit, and because he's more, because it's not his community, whatever. So they came to me with this, and they asked me if I would do some research on it, and they would follow my suggestion. So I met with the detectives. I actually watched all the videos, so that's why I know there was nothing other than the external pieces. I read everything. I did everything. I went through every tshuva on Isser and the Isser of Asura Labal, Asura Labal, everything. I spent months going through this stuff. Then one day, I found this one statement about, obviously, if the woman is an anusa, it doesn't apply. Now, I knew, because of these interviews I had, that this woman was being given drugs by this guy. And I knew from one mental health professional who was totally Shomer Shabbos in Yerushalayim that based on her activities in the morning, she was crying in her room, she was doing other things, that she was going through some type of nervous breakdown. So I wanted to taina that she was an anusa. She's on drugs, she's having this nervous breakdown, maybe she's an anusa. I called Rabbi Shechter because I was going to answer a shayla like this. And Rabbi Shechter said he didn't know, which I've never heard Rabbi Shechter say ever. Called Rabbi David Feinstein, Rabbi Reuven Feinstein. No one was willing to touch this. So I flew to Eretz Yisrael and I met with Rabbi Yashiv. And I wrote out every single word I wanted to say to Rabbi Yashiv, because number one is I was worried that my Hebrew is pretty good. My Yiddish doesn't exist, and that's what he normally uses, but my Hebrew is pretty good. I was afraid, you know, it's not like I meet with Rabbi Yashiv. It's the only time I had real, I mean, I met with him for an hour and a half, not for a 2-minute bracha type of thing. And I brought Rabbi Galinsky from Shalavim with me, so in case I couldn't get the Hebrew word out during the conversation, I could say it in English and Rabbi Galinsky would translate it for me. And he speaks Hebrew and Yiddish perfectly. So we had this conversation, and Rabbi Yashiv told me they can't get remarried. And I said to Rabbi Yashiv, I see their children in front of me, and I know their children's lives will be changed because they can't stay together as a family. Why can't we go with this anusa approach? And Rabbi Yashiv smiled, and he said, I want to really find out what happened in the room. You need to find out. I did my research, slept overnight in Eretz Yisrael. We weren't planning on going there just for those few hours. And talked to Rabbi Yashiv again the next day in the same structure and used Rabbi Frati, who's one of the shamashim, to help me with the dialogue. And Rabbi Yashiv wanted to corroborate it, what exactly was in the drugs, you know, and to get another mental health professional to corroborate it, the kitzur hamaisa. At the end of the day, Rabbi Yashiv wrote me a letter, which I still have. One of these days, when I have a few minutes, I'm going to publish some of this stuff, saying it was mutter for them to stay together, and there was no isser of Asura Labal, Asura Laboel, based on the issue of Anusa. Why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this story for the following reason. I do not personally feel that I had the right to answer that halachic question. I deal with end-of-life issues, I deal with infertility issues all the time. I'm not afraid to answer shilas. This one was too out of my league for me to answer. It needed a Gadol B'Yisrael. It happened not to be one, so it needed a Gadol B'Yisrael. But it was wrong for me to go to a Gadol B'Yisrael without doing my research. Because if I don't do my research, then what type of Rav am I? A Rav has to be holding in halacha. This might be the most important message that I communicate in this conversation. You have to be holding, and you have to make time to be holding. And it can't just be a social worker. It can't just be a good speaker. No. that those things are very important. You have to be holding in halacha. And if you speak to someone like Rabbi Schacht and Rabbi Willig, there's nothing wrong with asking them, where did they get their sources from, in a respectful way, so you can learn from that question that you're not just answering the question on the phone, but you're getting a certain depth yourself. And there is nothing wrong with going through the sources that they tell you to make sure that you understand them the same way. And if you don't, you call them back and say, excuse me, but I haven't please clarify those issues. It's very, very important that Rabbanim do not abdicate their halachic responsibilities to somebody else, but at the same time recognize the fact that the helping hand of a Rosh Yeshiva is extremely important, and it is the partnership, not ownership, but partnership, that really makes for an effective Rav and an effective Posek. Yes?
Wouldn't it make more sense for Rav to have like his own posek or his own halach and how to ask the child?
100%. Yes, that's very good. But the way you get a mahalach, and hopefully the way you get a mahalach in how to paskin is you do a survey of the halachic literature, and you feel where you see the light and you feel comfortable. I'm not comfortable with Rav Schoenbach, I told you that, but my goal here was to share with you not just my approach, my goal was to share with you material. And I thought it would be, even though I'm not happy with it, I thought it would be wrong for me not to share it with you, not because I want you to follow that Rav Schoenbach, but I want you to know it exists.
You mean comfortable, in a given area.
Comfortable, right. Intellectually, I think you should know that there are different, like for example, in the Mechitza issue, you'll see there's machlokas between the Rav and Rav Moshe Feinstein, whether Mechitza is a Daraisa din or Darabana din, and whether the issue of separation, it's not because the Rav and Rav Moshe Feinstein disagree with the din of Mechitza or not. They disagree in whether the etzem din of Mechitza is a din Daraisa or din Darabana. When I make a presentation to a group of individuals who are serious about their learning, which I assume everybody here is, then smicha, it would be wrong for me just to give you Rav Moshe's tshuva. I want to show you that there is a plethora of opinions, only because I think that from an intellectually honest perspective, I need to share that with you. If I was giving this shiur to a group of lay leaders, I probably would have the tshuva of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and maybe one or two other things. I wouldn't show them Rav Schoenbach. But I need to show you the literature. I mean, if I really did this properly, I would hand you 100 pages. But I'm happy if you just read this package, which I believe that, based on my personal experience in contemporary halacha, 50% of you will not read. So, but I didn't have someone giving a test like Rabbi Schwartz will. So maybe we'll up that percentage a little bit. So my idea is I want to share with you the world. I want to share with you the ideas. So that I put Rav Schoenbach in there, not because I think you should always run to Rav Moshe Feinstein on an issue, even though that's fine. But I think you should, when you do research on an issue, you have the responsibility to do just that, to do research on the issue. And then, as you do that research on a regular basis, you will become more knowledgeable on who to look at, who's more. I can tell you the Tzitz Eliezer's position on most medical ethics issues simply because I've read enough of the Tzitz Eliezer. And I can tell you that how the Chazon Ish deals with the laws of Shabbos versus Rav Moshe Feinstein. And there's significant differences. And I can, you know, tell you how Rav Moshe deals with certain other issues. Because if you read it enough, you start to get a handle on it. And that's what you need to do. In your spare time, you should be reading Tshuva Sfarim. It's an important thing to do. And it's not always heavy reading. It's an important reading to do. Yes?
As a Rav, suppose in such a situation, where you are 100% convinced after discussing the situation with a posek, a gadol, that you are correct, either in the matter of finding a fact or in determination of halacha, that the posek is incorrect. What do you do?
Well,
Well, in the case, let's take the last case I gave you. If Rav Yashiv at the end would have told me that they can't stay married, I would have told them they can't stay married, even though I was 100% convinced walking into that Rav Yashiv conversation that they should be allowed to stay married. I was 100% convinced. And I just needed to make my case to a higher authority, so to say. No, not so to say, to a higher authority. But the bottom line is, I think that that's not a din in Metzius, that's a din in understanding halakha. I felt that these issues, it's not an issue whether you're going to hold like lot kosher or not. This is an issue of Hilchos Ishus, which has mamzerus issues and a whole bunch of other issues in there. And I felt that those issues should not be discussed by an individual who's, you know, then situations 8 years old, so I was, you know, in my mid-30s, or younger than that, 32 or so. I didn't feel that I had the enough life experience to make a decision on Hilchos Ishus to that perspective. It's not about telling you whether a mar is good or not, which, you know, I'm not trying to puff it as Ister Abanan and all the other things of that nature. You know, this was a major issue, and I felt I needed shoulders to lean. I needed someone to lean on.
But this case aside, in theory,
I have never had a case, and I asked Shiloh a lot, where I couldn't, if I felt that the posek was wrong in the Metzius, that I couldn't make a compelling way for them to see it my way, even if it meant that the conversation had to continue in person instead of on phone, or bring the posek to the mountain instead of the mountain to the posek. In other words, there are times you have to do different things, but...
With regard to halakha.
What?
With regard to the determination of halakha.
I'm sure there are other rabbanim who would say otherwise. For me personally, if it was a posek that I trusted, and they told me that my understanding of halakha was wrong, I would follow the posek. I'm not saying that all rabbanim who have the same amount of experience I have would say the same thing. It's what I would do. It's what I would do. Now, I have to tell you, again, I'll tell you a story that I never forget. There was one night, I'm staying in the Rav's apartment in Mord now, during the days I'm here. It's a very uncomfortable place for me to be, because when I was in YU, I lived in that apartment with the Rav. So being in that apartment now is very uncomfortable because of all the memories that it brings back, although they redid it and everything else of that nature. So I'll never forget, there was one night that at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, the Rav was like walking around in the living room, and I got up, and I asked him why he's walking around, and not that he got up so much later than that anyways, but the bottom line is that he said to me he knows emotionally what he wants to tell a couple, but he knows that halacha dictates something else. And he has to tell them what halacha says, not what his emotions say. In a case in which a posek that I have a relationship with and I trust 100% would say one thing, I would not say something else. I'll give you an example of that. I just came to my mind. I personally feel that we're going to need the issues for a second. There's the issue of da makom oso makom. That there's an isser of da makom oso makom is not an isser of nida. If you have you guys have done nida yet? There's a halacha that if the dam has to come from the makor, the dam comes from the uterus, it's dam nida. But if it was caused by an injury, it's not hormonally induced, it's not dam nida. What about a polyp? A polyp is like a growth in the uterus. And sometimes the uterus is so small that if there's a growth in the uterus and you rub against the wall, it causes blood to come out. So I thought that a polyp should be dam maka. But Rav Menachem Vershti of Mahompua feels that that a polyp is not dam maka because sometimes there's hormonal blood. So when I wrote an article in the Journal of Contemporary Halacha, I wrote that Rav first wrote in his book that dam maka, that polyp is dam maka. I wrote in the article in the Journal of Contemporary Halacha that dam maka that polyp blood is dam nida. Because that's what my teachers taught me when I went through the sugyas. They taught me that, and I even showed the scientific proof even though in the back of my mind I'd be much more comfortable if they told me it was Don Maka. Turns out the first in this newer edition actually changed his feelings on polyps and fibroids, and he also says they're Dom Nida now. There's a tshuva of Rav of the Tzitz Eliezer that says that polyps and fibroids is Dom Maka, not Dom Nida, against Mechon Pua, Rav Nachum Burstein. I still follow Rav Burstein because I trust him on all the other halakhic issues and Dom Nida I ask, and I trust his clarity of vision on all the other issues. So if there's one point that I don't see eye to eye, even though I'm pretty sure that, you know, at the end of 120 years, that I'm going to win in the heaven on this issue, but I feel that I have to follow the way he's taught me. I'm not saying that you have to follow that approach. It's important to realize, it's not that I'm not afraid to articulate halakhic positions. I just feel when you turn to a posek and you have a long relationship with them, you should honor what they say. Yes.
Now that I say it's about people, I mean, obviously that human cure is not a person to Theresa. Why would Rabbi say the reason is because
neither is visiting the ill, neither is being Menachem Avelim, neither is a lot of, you know. So why is what?
Okay, so why? That's the why is it all.
First of all, according to the Rambam, I think mitzvah gimel, it is a mitzvah kiruv. And according to others who say Hashabbos Aveda, Lo Tamar Adam Re'acha, they're saying it is a mitzvah d'oraisa.
It's not, you know, the person for
us,
we should try to encourage.
Neither, you're going to set Kedusha now?
Yeah.
Neither is kicha mitzvah Ephraim, a person in the Torah. If you look at the Rambam Hilchos, he'll actually say that the kinyan through a ring is with Divrei Sofrim. He doesn't call it Daraita. My point is that not everything is mentioned. The idea of Hashavas Aveda, according to most Rishonim, means Hashavas Aveda of the soul also, not just of the physical. And let's assume it wasn't a mitzvah, even though I truly believe it is, and I think the Rambam clearly says it's a mitzvah Daraita, and others do. Jewish continuity is going to depend on making sure that our shuls are open to others. That's, you know, we're interested here in guaranteeing the future of the Jewish people, right? That's what I'm here for. So that's what, if we have to do that, then we should reach out to those that we have the ability to reach out to. Yes?
Yes, Rabbi, how do you deal with the issue of modest dress codes? Who doesn't come up in dress?
That's a very good question. Actually, Rav Moshe Feinstein actually deals with it also. It's a very important Rav Moshe Feinstein, where he deals with subjective erva and objective erva. Subjective erva, no, that's basically, the Aruch HaShulchan also has that. Subjective erva and objective erva. In other words, there are certain parts of the body that are objective forms of erva, and there are other forms that are cultural forms of erva. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says that you're allowed to say brachas in front of a woman who's not covering her hair, because that's no longer considered a total form of erva. It's because culturally there's a lot of women who walk around with that. He wouldn't say that if a woman had other parts of her anatomy exposed. What I have tried to do in issues of that, and it's a very, very good point, is we have ushers in the women's sections. It's not such a big problem now, because it's, we have 600 families in the shul, and they're basically all Shomer Shabbos. It's a little bit easier, but there was a time that was not the case. So the biggest problem, especially in Florida, when it's hotter than this room, and that is that people would come in sleeveless. How do you deal with that? So that actually might be, I'm not sure, that might be subjective, that might not be objective erva, but obviously I'm not comfortable with a woman in shul being sleeveless. I'm not sure, I have to really think that out, whether it's subjective or objective, but it's irrelevant. What we did was, we had sweaters of different sizes, night sweaters of different sizes, like white ones that would fit with everything, not one that would clash. And we had an usher who was specially trained by me, a woman, who would go over to her and say, this is a synagogue, we would appreciate it if you would wear this nice sweater. Sweaters were not dirty. It wasn't one size fits all. If the woman was petite, she had an extra large, and if she was an extra large, she had a petite sweater that looked like, you know, her baby sweater. we had different sizes, and we still have that. Or sometimes a woman will come, and also when for smachot, when someone has a bar bat mitzvah, we mandate that they send out a very nice card that I wrote. Which again, now that I'm thinking about it, I should get you all copies of that card so you can have it for yourself. We ask you not to wear abbreviated sleeves, right? It's a very good language. A lot of time went into that language. You guys are going to appreciate that language. If you never use the card, you'll at least appreciate the language. But we sent it out so that people know not to come like that. Tznius issues have to be dealt with. There has to be a standard, but you should try to do it in a user-friendly way. Regarding covering the hair, so we have the doilies that everybody else has in that case. You know, I'm Somech and Rav Moshe in that case. There was a time in which I wanted to get shawls, like these shawls. And I was told by the women who gave me advice on that the sweaters were one thing, but the shawls, there was no way that women would wear it on a regular basis. So I just decided to quit while I was ahead, so to say. But the bottom line is that you have to deal with it. Now, if there's a woman that comes to show on a regular basis, who's not a guest, and she dresses inappropriately, my wife would call her and go out to, you know, lunch or something like that, and build up a reservoir of a relationship, and at one point in time in that relationship suggest to her that maybe she follow the dress code of everybody else, the place. But you have to put some deposits in the bank, so to say, of goodwill, before you have that discussion with somebody. But I would definitely not shy away from having that conversation. And if somebody else was able to have that conversation better, I would have them do that. Yes?
So, side point, with the husband and wife in the back, where were they living during your Shakur Italia?
They were living separately.
It was before something they were living separately, or?
I don't remember. It wasn't a well-known thing around the community that this was going on. It was known by the Rabbanim and a few friends. Yes?
Was that catering hall actually in the shul itself?
I don't think it was. And I personally would not allow a catering hall in a shul to have, you know, that's a whole thing. Thank God it's not an issue I had to deal with, but from the perspective of we never had a formal caterer, but that is an issue for shuls, and a rav needs to recognize, here's where the fifth volume of Shulchan Aruch comes in. You see, technically, a shul catering hall, if there's mixed dancing, the shul has done nothing wrong, it's not l'fnei iver, because of what we just said. It's clearly not l'fnei iver. And most caterers will not agree to sign a contract with a shul if you won't allow mixed dancing because you've cut out a good part of their business. So the question is, what do you do? I was able to make a rule in the shul that there was no mixed dancing in any event. But I don't want you to view me as a tzaddik on this. It's just that catering was not a major revenue source, because the shul was very young. But now that the shul, the children that were born from the shul are now becoming bar mitzvah and now having weddings. So it was easy for me to be, I was able to get away with it. I'm not sure if the rabbi who's going to take my place is going to be able to get away with it. It also helps when you raise the money to build a catering hall, so people give you a little bit more freedom and those halakhic issues. But the bottom line is, that I was able to make the rule that there was no thing. It's always important to say this. Shuls that have catering halls that allow mixed dancing should not be viewed as doing something wrong. I think there's no lifnei iver problem. I personally had the rule as a shul rav that if there was mixed dancing at the event, then I would leave the event at that point in time. I wouldn't stay. Which, what happened was, in the evolution of events in the community, mixed dancing became post-Birkat HaMazon experience, so the rabbi could pay for the meal and bench, and then there was mixed dancing. That's what that was stage two in the thing. Now it's at a point where most events have no mixed dancing at all for that reason. Okay, I did not finish the mechitza issue. I didn't start the mechitza issue. Can I just give you a tour of what I wanted to say there? To just show it to you for a minute. On page 12, you have the major sources in it. Page 13, you have Rav Moshe's tshuva, which goes for several pages. Until page 19. Page 20, you have a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Also, that's important because it discusses Stira within the Rambam, which I wanted to get into, which I didn't get into. Page 22 has the use of glass as a mechitza, as part of mechitza. Page 23 has a three-day aish and discussing the different sizes. Page 25 has the Tzitz Eliezer in the issue. There's a very important letter from Rabbi Soloveitchik on page 27 of your handout that I photocopied from Conservative Judaism, fall 1956, that I wanted you guys to see. There's a very important book called The Sanctity of the Synagogue on this issue. There's some very good articles in there, one by Rav Lam, and another article by the Rav. So I put those in there. And if you really read this part properly, you'll get a really good overview on the mechitza issue. Okay? All right, stop here. I just want to make one other comment. If any of you guys want to, like, you know, spend time together and schmooze, it would be my pleasure to do so. So just email me or call me.